What if your nation's flag was less recognizable than the minerals exported from your lands? In fact, what if the place where you lived basically had no flag?
Again and again in eastern Congo, in the diamond fields in Zimbabwe, in this kind of oil-fueled, rule-by-fear society that has developed in Angola, places like Guinea, again and again and again, I would see this juxtaposition of deep human poverty, and often suffering, and often violence, next to the world's richest repositories of bauxite, of diamonds, of copper, of oil, of natural gas. And it's not a coincidence. The one causes the other, I think.
The relationship between resources and human suffering is the subject of Thomas Burgess's new book, The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. Burgess says economic growth due to demand for natural resources mostly conceals how resource economies like those operating in many nations in Africa actually hold their citizens in extreme poverty.
There's been this narrative of Africa rising, which is pretty nonsensical in two ways. Both of the words in it don't make a lot of sense. The idea of Africa as one homogenous blob and the notion of rising. I think certainly there are pockets of Africa where there's great entrepreneurial explosions, someone like Lagos, a lot more business being done. And in parts of coastal Africa, for sure, the last few years have seen a kind of commodity boom and what have you. But by and large, there are still massive human problems in Africa. I'll give you one example. Angola was growing at double digits for a decade. I think one year it was the fastest growing country in the world. But a much more revealing statistic for me is if you take those growth numbers, GDP per head, girls' education, gender measures, these things that really affect how people's lives are lived, and you subtract one from the other and you get another table, and that will show you that Angola and other resource producers in Africa, several of them are clustered at the very, very bottom of this. And that shows you that they are doing the worst at turning booming macroeconomic growth into improved living standards. And the suggestion, I think, is that that just demonstrates that little elites at the top are creaming off the vast majority of that benefit.
And what the bottom looks like is shown in some other statistics that you write about, and that is that in many of these resource-rich African countries, you have huge percentages of the population living below the $1.25 extreme poverty number mm-hmm. for incomes. And that just seems just unsustainable on every level.
Well, it's just something that I think we don't think about. We think of Africa as being very poor, and vast numbers of people in Africa are, as you say, very poor. But there's also immense natural wealth. There's like $350 billion roughly goes out of Africa every year in exports of oil and minerals. You take somewhere like the DRC, Congo, enormous country, the size of Western Europe. And the guys who are close to the president, there's one Israeli tycoon in particular, Dan Gertler, have made fortunes trading in the rights to copper mines. But there, that figure for the number of people who live under $1.25, it's about 88%.
Oh, my God.
And the state doesn't really exist. Everybody is just out, as I try to argue in the book, it's a kind of roadblock economy. Everyone wants to seize a piece of land and extract some rent from it, whether that be the presidency capturing the copper rights to a checkpoint in a militarized area in the east. It becomes, at every level, a rent economy, which is the poisonous thing that happens when your economy is completely dependent on the export of minerals.
You know, one of the things that you say in this book that I think takes it to a different level, there have been many social scientists and development folks who have reminded us that among the places in the world where there is no nation, where there are millions of people living without any governance at all, Africa is among those places that has the most people in that circumstance. You make the point that the rent economy that you describe in these places of riches, whether we're talking about Central African Republic or Congo or Angola, don't require governance to function. That many innovatively have just said, forget what the UN is saying. We're just going to ditch the government altogether and take our wealth and let the people sort of survive as they need. We'll have enough weapons around here to keep it from getting completely out of control, but we're happy with the situation, and go to Congo and that's all you have to see.
We being the top level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that this term I kept coming across was a kind of shadow state, more in Congo, in Nigeria, in Zimbabwe especially. People would say, people of all levels would have this sense that there is a sort of facade of a state. Yeah, there's a finance ministry, there's a central bank, there's a military. But really, power resided behind that. It's generally kind of these coteries around the presidency and the top military guys. And it's something between kind of the Davos world and the Victor Boot world. Somehow these things become fused.
Victor Boot, the arms trader.
Victor Boot, the arms trader, would sit in Eastern Congo in the bars there and hear tales of how Boot used to come in and trade AK-47s for Coltan, which would go out and people would make mobile phones from it. Mm. I mean, these networks, these shadow states that, as you say, leave massive amounts of people behind in a big informal economy, they've become detached. And so it's incredibly hard for some of the really brave activists in the Niger Delta or Angola or Zimbabwe to call them to account because they only have national institutions to do that through, if that makes sense.
Well, what makes sense in a chilling way, as I think of sort of the opposite of what you've just said, is every time you take a call on your cell phone or play around on your smartphone, you're essentially waving the flag of these stateless, extreme poverty populations that have no one to go to.
I think so. I think I had to grapple with this a lot, this idea of the extent to which we are all complicit in this. We get in a big fuss if a sweatshop collapses in Bangladesh and we know that they were making our soccer balls or our T-shirts or whatever for a particular company. There would be boycotts, there would be outrage, that company would be under great pressure. Similarly, we're all obsessed with where our coffee comes from and whether it's been bought through some kind of fair trade arrangement and something that's not exploitative. But in this studio, as in any other room in the country, we're surrounded by copper wiring, aluminum. We drove here in cars that were running on often African crude. We proposed to our lovers with diamonds from some of the most troubled parts of Africa. And yet we seem either oblivious to that connection or unwilling to address the notion that these basic material comforts that we enjoy in the rich world are sometimes indirectly but very strongly linked to violence, very low standards of living, and rampant misrule on the other side of the ocean.
Tom Burgess is a reporter for the Financial Times. His new book is The Looting Machine. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you very much.